Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Eugenio Duarte. I hope you enjoy the interview you're about to listen to. If you do, or if you have ideas for books you'd like to hear about on the show, let me know. Go to my website, eugenioduartephd.com, and click on Contact to send me a message. And now on with the interview. Hello, everybody. This is New Books in Psychology, and I'm your host, Eugenio Duarte, in New York. Today, I'm talking to Dr. John J. Pitney, Jr., author of the book, The Politics of Autism, Navigating the Contested Spectrum, published in 2015 by Roman and Littlefield. Dr. Pitney Jr. is a Roy P. Crocker Professor of American Politics at Claremont McKenna College. He is the author of The Art of Political Warfare and the co-author of several books, including Epic Journey, The 2008 Elections and American Politics, as well as After Hope and Change, The 2012 Election and American Politics. In addition to his scholarly work, he has held staff positions in the U.S. Congress and the New York State Legislature. He maintains several blogs, including Autism Policy and Politics. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So could you start by telling us about your professional background in autism?
Well, I don't have a professional background in autism per se. My PhD is from Yale, where I studied public policy issues with Theodore Marmor, who's a leading expert on healthcare policy. Worked on insurance issues in the New York State Legislature, which, as it turns out, is a major part of autism policy and politics. As for autism itself, a lot of it comes from the experience of a family member who is on the spectrum, and that introduced me in a very direct way to the world of autism and to the many unanswered questions surrounding it.
When did you first start focusing on autism within your political science work?
This was after my family member's diagnosis. Didn't really know a great deal about autism before that, and this was approximately in the year 2004. But as we continued on the journey and I learned more, I realized that there was relatively little writing in political science on the subject. There is a scholar, Dana Baker, at Cal State Channel Islands, who has written about it and continues to write about it. The late Trudy Stornagel at Kent State probably wrote some of the foundational pieces on autism. Unfortunately, she died tragically in 2009 in an incident that involved her son, who was severely affected on the spectrum. So I figured that given my background in public policy in general and some firsthand exposure to the issue, I thought it would be a valuable contribution to write something more systematically about the topic.
Now, on this channel, we usually talk about the psychology of different kinds of experiences or conditions. So some of our listeners might be wondering, what exactly does a political scientist do, and what might a political scientist or a political science perspective have to offer autism?
Those are great questions. Political scientists study government and politics. Harold Lasswell, a great political scientist of the early 20th century, referred to politics as the science of who gets what and why. It encompasses the obvious institutions of government, federal government in the states here in the United States, as well as comparative politics, comparisons between the United States and other countries. But it also encompasses topics of public policy and interest groups. And all of this comes into play in the area of autism. People may wonder, well, what does autism have to do with politics? And there are a couple of answers to that. One is that much of the funding for autism treatment comes from government. Here in the state of California, the regional centers pay for a great deal of applied behavior analysis. There are also, in most states now, laws requiring insurance companies to pay for ABA. And many other issues are implicated as well. The Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which largely governs special education in the schools, is tremendously important for families dealing with autism. And there, it's also political in a much broader sense as well. Politics involves what counts as an issue. How do issues come to the fore? How do issues enter the public sphere? And that, I think, is at least as interesting as the specific policy and process issues involved in autism. As most of listeners may know, autism as we know it was not identified until the 1940s by Leo Kanner in the United States and Hans Asperger working in Austria. It really didn't become a truly major national issue until the 1990s, after the passage of a law in 1990, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which was a revision of the Education for All Handicapped Children Act, that provided for reporting of data. And we find since 1990, the number of reported cases of autism in the schools has increased. That's driven largely by the reporting process itself. One of the unanswered questions, and nobody really knows the answer, has the actual prevalence, the true prevalence of autism increased over the years. Much of the reported increase in prevalence reflects greater awareness and more systematic reporting, but no one can say for sure that there has not been a true increase in prevalence, and that will remain controversial for a long time to come.
For our listeners who may not really know, what exactly is autism, and how has the definition changed over time?
It's also an excellent question, and autism is a disorder or a difference of social communication. The definition has indeed changed over the years. During the early years of autism research, there was a fairly restrictive definition, and the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, of the American Psychiatric Association has been revised several times, laying out different diagnostic criteria for autism, which means that as a result of these changes, the reported prevalence has changed. At one time, there was an estimate that maybe 1 in 10,000 people would count for to be on the spectrum. Then it was 1 in 50, 1 in 150. And now the most recent estimate in both the United States and Canada, it's somewhere in the vicinity of 1 in 60 or 1 in 66. Another complication is that the criteria used in the DSM are not necessarily the same as the criteria used by schools. So the DSM diagnosis definition of autism isn't necessarily that which guides schools, and that may lead to some differences and some anomalies in the statistics. But the best overall definition is a problem in social communication, and it varies widely. That's why we have the phrase autism spectrum. There are people who are autistic who are very verbal, who have no problem with writing. They do have problems with social communication, but have managed to make very successful careers. And then you have other people on the spectrum who are nonverbal, who may also have diagnosis of intellectual disability. So the spectrum is very broad. It encompasses a wide variety of symptoms, leading to the phrase that's familiar to the autism community: if you know one person with autism, you know one person with autism. As time goes on, we may have a more refined definition that divides it into various categories, various kinds of autisms, plural. But that is in the future. Right now, the term encompasses a very broad and sometimes very confusing array of symptoms.
So you said that politics is what decides what is an issue. So how is autism an issue, not just for the individuals who deal with it, but how is it an issue for the country as a whole?
Sure. It's an issue for the country as a whole in a variety of ways. First, when you look at the legislation providing for social services and special education, those policies are administered by agencies of government and paid for by the taxpayers. That is very much a public issue, a political issue. You also have the regulations that come into play, the laws mandating insurance coverage by health insurance companies. That's been a very big issue in state legislatures, most recently in Georgia. Again, another political issue. Then you have the very controversial matter of the theory, largely disproved, that vaccines have something to do with autism. That became much more prominent in the United States in the 1990s and early 2000s with Andrew Wakefield, a British physician whose license to practice was eventually pulled by the British authorities. He published a paper, again, retracted by The Lancet, that suggested that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine had something to do with autism. It turns out it doesn't. But that gave an impetus to the notion that vaccines cause autism. And to this very day, a number of people believe in it. They're delaying vaccinations, which in turn leads to other political issues, that is, laws in the states that require school children to be vaccinated before they can attend school. So these are just some of the political and policy issues that come into play. There are others as well. Take, for instance, law enforcement. Very often people on the spectrum, because of their difficulties in social communication, may have problematic interactions with law enforcement. There is a case just a couple of months ago in Buckeye, Arizona, where there was an autistic youth who was in a park, basically minding his own business, not bothering anybody, but he was stimming, that is, engaging in self-stimulatory behavior, flapping his hands. That's something that many people on the autism spectrum feel a need to do. police officer spotted him, didn't understand what was going on, and thought that this person might be on drugs. As a body cam video showed, the officer approached him and the situation spun out of control. The police officer arrested him, and now that has led to a great deal of legal trouble for the city of Buckeye. And that's just one of many incidents where interactions between first responders and people on the spectrum have gone south. That's why a number of police departments and fire departments have brought in people to train first responders in recognizing the symptoms of the spectrum and dealing with people on the spectrum. And that is a positive development. That also is part of the broader range of political issues that autism involves. Well, that's a great question. And particularly when it comes to special education, the system in the United States puts a great deal of burden on parents to be advocates for their children. In the schools, for instance, you go into an IEP, individual education program, the IEP meeting. Sometimes those meetings can be very contentious. The parents who do best are the parents who can afford to get some kind of assistance, either in the form of a parent advocate or an attorney. And sometimes parents do not get the plan that they want, and so that they will take those plans into due process, a procedure that's laid out in law and regulation. And the parents who know to do this are often parents with money and education and professional connections. Parents without these advantages generally just take what they can get. And that leads to considerable inequality in the services available to people with autism and other disabilities. That is a major political problem. And if you look more broadly at the array of services that are available from other levels of government here in California, the regional centers, the parents must have to know that the regional centers are there. They need to work with advocates. They need to know, frankly, how to work the system. And without very vigorous parent advocacy, young people on the spectrum probably aren't going to do as well as they could. So this is, as we move forward, an ongoing problem for people with autism and other disabilities. Because so much depends on the parents, a lot of advantage accrues to parents who already have economic and social advantages.
What are some of the specific services or accommodations that people with autism need that are most difficult to get?
Probably the one that most autism families will talk about is ABA, Applied Behavior Analysis, sometimes referred to as the gold standard of autism treatment. It applies the principles of behavioral psychology, breaking tasks down into individual parts, and providing reinforcement to people on the spectrum, usually young people on the spectrum, to change behavior, to acquire a broader range of behavior. For example, maintaining eye contact. Many kids on the spectrum have difficulty making and maintaining eye contact, and ABA often is used to get them to develop greater skill at eye contact. Now, as I point out in the book, everything about autism is controversial, and ABA is no exception. Even though there's a good deal of literature behind this method, there are critics, and especially critics among self-advocates, people on the autism spectrum. Some of them are very unhappy with their own experience with ABA. very critical of the way it's administered. And, you know, I'm in no position to resolve that controversy, but it illustrates the broader point that, again, nearly everything about autism ultimately is political, and nearly everything about autism is contentious. As I explained to my colleagues on college campuses, autism politics is like faculty politics on crystal meth, very contentious and sometimes very emotional.
Do you mind sharing what some of the critiques are of ABA?
Sure. There is a significant evidence base of ABA. There is quite a bit of literature. But as I understand it, let me emphasize, I'm not a psychologist here. But as I understand the criticism is that the focus is on behavior, not thought. And critics of ABA argue that it trains people to imitate neurotypical behavior without developing necessarily cognitive function, without necessarily developing the ability to think. And that's that's one level of criticism. Another level of criticism goes back to the origins of ABI. Ivar Lovaas at UCLA was one of the major figures in developing ABA as a treatment for autism. And critics will point out that Lovaas initially used aversive techniques, that is, shocks and slaps, as part of the repertoire. ABA has long abandoned that, but the origins are still troubling to people who look at the history. And also Lovaas, very early on, was one of the psychologists who tried to use similar techniques get people to stop being gay, which we know now is, how bad that is, I think is well known. But it's something that that causes a great deal of controversy, even though ABA hasn't been used that way in decades. So those are some areas of controversy. And the comeback for the advocates of ABA is this: what's the alternative? There are other approaches, but right now ABA is the approach that appears to have the greatest empirical foundation. Perhaps at some point in the future there'll be another approach that has more support and more foundation. But from the standpoint of policymakers, you go with the best thing that's available. Now, when it comes to ABA, a lot is going to depend on the people who administer it. In most ABA programs, a psychologist will develop the program, but the actual day-to-day contact with kids on the spectrum belongs to therapists who are not psychologists. Very often they're college students or recent college graduates, and the quality will vary. Some people have a talent for this and some don't. Some people are very good at it and some aren't. And that's one of the reasons why the results are not necessarily consistent. Not everybody benefits equally from ABA. And part of the reason is not everybody who administers ABA is equally good.
It makes me wonder if you could give us a glimpse into the typical week of a family with a child with autism trying to make sure that that child goes to therapy. I'm wondering how many days a week is this and how many hours. Logistically, what does it involve for parents to get their children this kind of therapy?
Well, that's a great question. And one of the battles parents often have to fight is getting the hours, either through a social service agency or through their school. The gold standard for ABA is 40 hours a week. This is extremely, time intensive. And typically, the therapists come to the home. and the therapist will sit with the child and often in a play setting, and ask them to do various things such as maintain eye contact or try to maintain a quiet posture for a short period of time, a variety of things. But 40 hours a week, and obviously as children get older, the behaviors involved are more complex. But that's only part of it, and that's why the whole issue of autism is so complicated. Only part of the ABA is only the beginning. There's also speech therapy. Many people on the spectrum have difficulty with speech. And those difficulties range, on the one hand, from people who are nonverbal, who cannot speak at all, who never, in fact, develop the power of speech, to people who can talk, but the prosody, the rhythm and tone are atypical and very distinctive. So speech therapists come into play as well. There is occupational therapy, which can encompass matters of balance and coordination, but also the ability to deal with various textures. Many people on the spectrum have difficulty with certain kinds of clothing. That may sound like a trivial concern, but for people on the spectrum, wearing, for instance, wool is like wearing sandpaper. Feeding is an issue. Many people on the spectrum have food aversions, and we're not talking about the typical picky eating that so many kids have. We're talking about a phenomenon where when a person on the spectrum may have a sip of apple juice, that person's brain processes the taste as if it were battery acid. And so as a result, many kids on the spectrum have very, very restricted diets, and that leads to various health problems. And speaking of health problems, many people on the spectrum have co-occurring conditions such as gut problems. And so they have to see other kinds of medical professionals as well. Adaptive physical education, often offered at schools. Many people on the spectrum are poorly coordinated, and I don't mean just not picked for the team, as so many people are, but have difficulty with very, very basic functions. And so when you add it all up for kids on the spectrum, the life of a parent is a life of appointments. The ABA is delivered at home, but many of the other services involve appointments. And if you're in a rural area, you may have to drive for a very long time to reach your appointment. That's why autism is never easy, but it's probably a bit easier to be an autism family in a major city or suburb than in a rural area. And again, inequality is part of the picture here. People in these urban areas have an advantage over people who have to drive long distances and may not have the resources to be effective advocates for their children.
I want to also talk about education, as I understand from what you say in the book that this is another area in which there are heated political issues. What are some of the political issues involved in making sure autistic children get the kind of education and accommodations that they need?
Sure. There's a phrase called the dilemma of difference. The dilemma of difference is this. On the one hand, if you treat the more that you treat kids with autism and other disabilities differently, you raise the risk of stigma. If kids are pulled out of class for services, if they are in an identifiable special education class, the other kids are going to notice and regard them differently. But if you treat people with disabilities exactly the same, then you're not dealing with those disabilities, and that's a problem too. And that's a balance, and that's a dilemma that that every school and every disability family has to deal with. There's also the level of services. How much service is the school going to pay for? What kinds of service? This has been not only a political issue, but a significant legal issue in the interpretation of the law. First, the Education for All Handicapped Children Act, and then the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. For a long time, the controlling Supreme Court decision, the Rowley case, was a problem for families because it indicated that the schools could get away with a very, very low and basic level of service. More recently, a very recent development in the Supreme Court, the so-called Andrew F. case, suggests that the courts are going to hold schools to a much higher standard, and that people receiving disability, receiving special education in the United States are entitled to a much higher level of service. Now, how this case actually plays out in schools across the country remains to be seen, again, because so much falls on the parents and on their ability to be advocates for their children and on their ability to get professional assistance. But I think most disability families, most autism families were very heartened by the Supreme Court decision in Andrew F.
But referring back to the first case that you cited that allowed schools to implement a standard that held them less responsible for providing services, what was the legal rationale that allowed that?
Well, the case was so-called Rowley case involving Amy Rowley, who is a hearing impaired person who's to this day is an advocate for people with disabilities. And her parents wanted her to have a much higher level of support in the form of sign language interpretation. Went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the court ruled that the language of the statute didn't necessarily provide that level of service, didn't have that requirement in it. And Andrew F. Has applied a higher standard. Some of the problem lay in the ambiguity of the law itself. If you read the statute, it's not absolutely clear what level of service students are entitled to. And Andrew F. Is a resource for parents to demand more. Another problem here is that the foundational laws were written basically not with autistic people in mind. The Education for All Handicapped Children Act, for example, was a reaction to some lower court cases involving people with intellectual disabilities. The Americans with Disabilities Act, championed by people in Congress, including Bob Dole, had a focus on people with visible physical disabilities. Bob Dole, of course, lost the use of his right arm in World War II. There were others. Evan Kemp, who was head of the EEOC at the time, was in a wheelchair, used a wheelchair. There was relatively little attention to autism, in part because autism was not as prominent then as it is today. If we were starting from scratch, writing IDEA and ADA today, there would probably be much more specific acknowledgement of the unique challenges of autism, and that would be written into the statute. But as it is, courts and regulators have to infer those standards from the often ambiguous language that's in the law books.
Do you think that the way a government handles something like autism reflects a country's deeper values and worldviews?
Definitely. It also reflects the structure of the government because the United States has an extremely complicated system of government. There are over 80,000 different governments in the United States. If you look at states, localities, counties, school districts, and all the rest. And that adds to the complexity facing the families of people with autism and other disabilities. In a way, though, it can be a bit of an advantage, because if you don't get what you want from one level or one government agency, you can appeal it to another. But this, again, gives advantages to the families with the resources and the wherewithal to do that. In many respects and many issues, the United States has been subject to a lot of criticism in its social welfare policies. Before the enactment of the Affordable Care Act, we were the only major developed country without national health insurance, for example. However, when it comes to autism, although there isn't a great deal of comparative research, the United States actually does reasonably well in comparison with other countries. In some countries, there still remains a stigma surrounding autism. In other countries, the treatment of autism is not very well developed. The government does not provide the kind of resources that we do in the United States. So it's not easy to be autistic anywhere in the world. But if I were on the spectrum, I'd probably prefer to be in the United States than most other countries.
I'm also wondering what it's like to be a person researching autism in this country. Can you say something about the current state of research into autism and how it's affected, either hampered or encouraged by governmental policy?
Oh, that is also an excellent question. There is a governmental body, the IAC, the Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee, that is, in a sense, a broad coordinating body for the various levels of autism research financed by the federal government. Not surprisingly, it's complicated. There are a variety of government agencies that subsidize autism research in various ways. And one that might be very surprising is the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense, DOD is a major funder of autism research. Now,
why?
Well, because Congress said so. Because DOD had some money, and members of Congress figured, okay, we can earmark some of this to autism research. There isn't necessarily any rhyme or reason to that, but believe me, I study Congress, and it's not surprising there isn't any rhyme or reason to it. Department of Health and Human Services is a major funder of autism research. National Institutes of Health, National Institute of Mental Health, the Education Department. And also, there are, in addition to all of that, there are a variety of private foundations that fund it as well. All that said, the focus of research is, like everything else in autism, controversial. Self-advocates point out that a large portion of the money in autism research is going to research on genetics and biology. They argue that much more should be going to improving the quality of services in the here and now. And this gets to some very different perspectives. If you talk to parents of kids who are very severely affected by autism, they very much support some kind of medical intervention. To put it very crudely, they're looking for the pill for autism. They're looking for the so-called cure. There are other people, many autistic self-advocates, who find that attitude to be deeply offensive. Years ago, there was one version of the statute was called the Combating Autism Act, and they objected to that because they're saying, if you're combating autism, you're combating me. A lot of the self-advocates regard autism as part of their identity, something that they embrace. So they're extremely dubious of the measures to so-called cure autism, and they want to focus more of the research efforts, again, to helping people in the here and now, getting adaptations and assistive devices for people who are nonverbal. So this is an issue that is extremely contentious, extremely controversial, because it really gets to people's lives, the way they live their life and their whole sense of identity.
So when you said earlier that there's a certain faction of research that is looking into biology and genetics associated with autism, what are the implications of that? Does that mean research into a cure or even research into ways of preventing it?
Well, again, this is like an onion. You peel one layer and you find another layer. This is this leads to yet more deep controversy. As it stands now, the only way to diagnose autism is to observe behavior. There is no medical test for autism. There's no blood test. There's no brain scan that can reliably diagnose autism. But some of the research may eventually point out to a blood test, something roughly akin to amniocentesis. And that raises many, many deep problems. What if, for example, there were a test that could tell you that a developing fetus had a strong likelihood of being autistic? That raises the entire issue of abortion. And that is potentially as controversial as it's possible to get in the political world. Because it's cross-cutting. Many people who are self-advocates for autism would normally be pro-choice, but they would regard something like that as very, very alarming. So that if perchance there ever were some kind of prenatal test for autism, that would unleash enormous controversy.
So what do you believe to be the prospects for government policy for autism services and research under the Trump administration?
One surprise in the Trump administration is this. During the campaign, Trump actually promoted the idea that vaccines cause autism, and it's something that he had said many times before. And during the transition, he briefly met with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who was a leading, to put it bluntly, conspiracy theorist promoting the idea of autism as a result of vaccines. And Kennedy said that Trump had promised to appoint him to a so-called vaccine safety commission. It turns out none of that's happened. There's no so-called vaccine safety commission, and Trump's appointments to key posts, Department of Health and Human Services, CDC, FDA, have tended to be people who are very pro-vaccine. So critics of Trump say that he betrays everybody, and in this case, a lot of serious people in the autism community say, thank God he betrayed the proponents of the vaccine theory. When it comes to research, however, the Trump administration proposed some significant overall cuts in scientific research, but Congress restored them. So the situation for funding for autism research, it looks a lot better than it did at the beginning of the administration. As time goes on, we'll see, because the government is under enormous fiscal pressure, and programs involving healthcare and scientific research could continue to be on the chopping block. But for now, it's not as bad as it seemed when he first took office.
The last chapter in your book addresses the future of autism and public policy. What should we expect?
Well, one, again, we don't know if the true prevalence of autism has increased. Nobody knows that for sure. But we do know for sure that the number of people with a recognized diagnosis of autism has increased, the people who know that they are autistic. And those numbers will continue to increase, particularly among adults. that's the next frontier of the issue. We often speak of autism as if it were a childhood condition. But if you're an autistic child, you're going to be an autistic adult. And services for adults on the spectrum are pretty poor, to put it bluntly. People talk about the so-called services cliff. Under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, once a person reaches his or her 22nd birthday, they no longer qualify. And there are relatively few programs at other levels of government to provide services and supports for such people. As more and more people with a recognized diagnosis of autism enter adulthood, there's going to be more pressure on the system to provide those services. In the longer run, another problem is this. For people who are more severely affected by autism and need home health care, there is going to be a squeeze on those services because of the aging of the baby boom generation, of whom I'm a member. More and more people are going to have Alzheimer's, and the people with Alzheimer's are also going to need home health care. So there's very likely to be a shortage of the people who provide such services. That is going to continue to be an issue. Also, we're going from a political standpoint, because we have more and more people on the spectrum reaching adulthood and who have benefited from ABA and services, there are going to be more and more autistic voters. There are going to be people who on the spectrum are exercising their rights as citizens. And we started to see this in recent years, and we're going to see far more activism on the part of autistic Americans and autistic citizens. And I would not be surprised if more and more of them get elected to office over time. And I think when that happens, we're going to see an even greater public awareness of the issue, and we may see some changes in public policy as a result.
Well, John, we're almost out of time, but before we go, you want to tell us what you're working on next?
Well, on a day-to-day basis, as you mentioned, I keep a blog, Autism Policy and Politics, autismpolicyblog.com. I update that every day. As far as my current project, it's actually not very closely related. It's a book about the 1988 presidential election, which after all these years is worth a second look. But there is a connection there because the person who won this that election was George H.W. Bush. And we tend to forget that the Bush administration actually played a very major role in bringing the Americans with Disabilities Act into the law books. And even though it didn't focus specifically on autism, it's been an important resource for people on the spectrum. And I think President George H.W. Bush deserves a lot of credit and deserves a good deal of gratitude from Americans for his work on the ADA.
Well, I look forward to that book coming out. I hope you'll let us know when it does so that you can come back and talk about it. I am curious to know, for our listeners who are interested, your blog, Autism Policy and Politics, what will people find there?
They will find daily updates. What I do every morning when I get up, I scan newspapers and magazines and the scientific literature for the latest updates. Sometimes it will be an excerpt from a newspaper story, sometimes an abstract of a medical journal article, sometimes a government report. But I do this just to stay current with the issue and to provide updates to people with an interest. I learn something every day, and the nature of the issue is there's always something more to learn.
And do you mind telling us again what the web address is for your blog?
www.autismpolicyblog.com.
Great. Well, John, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really enjoyed talking to you about such an important, but I guess also such a contentious issue. Thank you. Thank you for educating us about this.
Thank you very much.
Take care. This is Eugenio Duarte, your host for New Books in Psychology in New York. I hope that you enjoy the interview that you just listened to, and I also hope that you'll keep letting me know who you would like to hear on the show next or what books in psychology you're reading. To let me know, go to my website, eugenioduartephd.com, and click on Contact. Until next time, have a great week.